This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Where are the other poor black kids? This was the first question that Anthony Abraham Jack says he remembers asking himself when he started at Amherst College. He was suddenly surrounded by wealthy students talking about private jets and vacation homes. His first ever plane trip was just a few months prior. Terms like internship, study abroad, and professor's office hours were foreign concepts. Higher in his thoughts were choosing between buying books or buying food. But getting into a great college was half the battle. Jack was one of thousands of students nationwide who benefited from new policies aimed at enrolling more low-income students, policies like financial aid with no loans as part of the packages. But what happens when disadvantaged students get to college? Anthony Abraham Jack is now an assistant professor of education and a junior fellow at Harvard University. In a new book, he describes how disadvantaged students struggle at elite colleges and how schools can change to better support them. It's called The Privileged Poor: How Elite Colleges Are Failing Disadvantaged Students. Professor Jack, welcome to 1A.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into your personal experience, let's define this term, the privileged poor. Who are you referring to when you talk about the privileged poor?
I'm specifically talking about lower income students who receive scholarships to go to boarding day and preparatory high schools, because we don't think about lower income students at boarding schools and preparatory schools, yet they have scholarship programs just like colleges do. And a good number of their students get scholarships and go on to college. And we never pay attention to this alternative pathway to higher education, yet colleges hedge their diversity bets. They get a significant number. As my research shows, upwards of one half of the poor black students and one third of lower income Latino students in college actually graduate from private high schools. And we've missed that group in our research and in our policies. And I want to bring light and attention to this diversity because we've been missing out on half the picture.
Now, the rationale for you doing this has a lot to do with your own personal experience. You're from South Florida, as
yes.
am I. You're from a neighborhood in Miami called Coconut Grove.
I am.
Which is one of these interesting neighborhoods because Coconut Grove is literally like half rich, half poor.
Yes.
The part that's closest to the bay and the intracoastal waterway is beautiful. There's shops, restaurants. Miami City Hall sits in Coconut Grove. The other side is this like historically black Bahamian neighborhood that is very, very, very underserved and looks nothing like the other half of Coconut Grove. It's the kind of part of town where one might think that a kid like you would never make it to a prep school, let alone at Amherst.
No, yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, when you cross McDonald, you're in a different world. It is literally night and day. I think about the times that I would walk and see one thing when I'm on my way to school. You see people riding bikes, people walking their dogs and being happy. And then you go to the other side and you see people kind of watching where they're going. In my neighborhood, if you saw someone who was white, they were either a police officer, a crackhead, or someone looking to, or someone who was lost, or some combination thereof. You go to the other side. It's where Coco Walk is. It's where the movie theaters and where all the shops and the open malls. It was very different.
Yeah, you see like occasionally people who are like, which way is the Cheesecake Factory?
Yes.
And you know they are not from Coconut Grove.
No, they are not.
Now, you ended up going to a prep school called Gulliver Prep.
I went to Gulliver Prep, yes.
How did you get to Gulliver Prep?
I played football in high school. My brother always wanted me to play and, you know, I was a nerd. You know, I love my books. And I was like, okay, I'll give it a go. I wanted to have some fun after school. And I enjoyed it, but towards the end of the football season, my junior year, my shoulder came out, and I had a football coach who liked athlete students and not student athletes, and so there was a lot of battle between me and him because I was in the International Baccalaureate program, I was in AP classes.
I was an IB student too.
Oh, you were awesome.
Yeah, I got my IB diploma.
I do too. Yeah.
We'll talk about that after the show. Right.
And when he kicked me off the team, even though my shoulder was dislocated and I had to have surgery, I was like, well, you know what? No one's going to tell me that I can't finish something that I started. So we ended up going to Gulliver for my senior year. So it was only for 1 year for me, but that 1 year was like a trailer to what Amherst was soon to be. It gave me insight into how the top 10, top 5, top 1% lived because of the difference in the resources between what Gulliver easily gave students and what Gables, which was an IB school, scrape together to give students.
You describe in your book some of those differences in terms of not just the fact that it is a wealthier, you know, private prep school, but also what we commonly think of as cultural capital.
Yeah.
Even just knowing, like, how to shake somebody's hand when you introduce yourself to them. These little things that people who might come from a more privileged background would take for granted.
Yes. And when I think about cultural capital, and there's a lot of literature on it, I think about those taken for granted ways of being that are rewarded in different contexts. You're right. Like looking someone in the eye when you shake their hand, or just knowing how to act right or do right in a particular context. And you know, in school, it's about making your needs known or being more agentic in how you engage faculty members. But that is not something that everyone has access to, or let alone has had time to practice or master, right? So if you think about the pernicious effects of poverty, it shows that some students get the chance to not only hear these lessons at home and then reinforce at school, while others hear the opposite at home. They know how to behave in certain contexts. The problem is when colleges and people who do hiring at companies and organizations, they privilege a certain set of behaviors. And it's not something that low-income students typically have access to.
We heard from a number of low-income first-generation college students who did find it hard to fit in socially in college. Here's what one student left in our inbox.
Hi, my name is Tyler from Traverse City, Michigan. I grew up in a low-income family, and I graduated from an Ivy League university a few years ago. The university was very supportive in, you know, making it possible for me to attend through need-based grants and scholarships. However, socially, I felt really disconnected from a lot of my peers. Everything from spring break to, you know, going out to eat, certain activities in the community, I often wasn't able to participate, and I was trying to work part-time jobs on the side while, you know, trying to maintain the very tough curriculum and my coursework.
Tyler, thanks very much for calling in and sharing your story with us. This is kind of what you describe as being, is it doubly disadvantaged?
Doubly disadvantaged, yes. Lower income students who come from lower income backgrounds, but who have not been exposed to these hidden rules and these unset expectations, kind of like this hidden curriculum that operate on the college campus, both socially and academically. But because it is the social hurdles that get in the way of student success. It's incredibly important that we understand the ways in which the social undercurrents on a campus can really hurt how students navigate the rest of the 4 years there.
I know we have to pause in a moment, but that's kind of the point of the book, The Privileged Poor. You went back to school to interview disadvantaged students at a selective college, mm-hmm. which you kind of referred to as renowned university, yes. just as a generic name, to see what their experiences were. Before we pause, what did you expect to find? What did you set out to do with that?
I set out to actually understand how class and poverty shape how students move through campus. My work in the admissions office at Amherst as a diversity intern, I saw how Prep for Prep and A Better Chance had inroads into these schools, and those students had different experiences. I didn't go out to test if they, in fact, did have these experiences. I wanted to see how class and poverty worked on the college campus. And the privileged poor and the doubly disadvantaged emerged from that research and allowed me to say when and how class matters.
We'll dig deeper into that research as we continue with Anthony Abraham Jack of Harvard University, the author of the book, The Privileged Poor. There are some universities that are trying to help these students acclimate. Georgetown has such a program, and we'll speak to the director of that program in just a moment. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Babbel. Have you always wanted to speak a new language? Whether it's for travel, work, or brain training, Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons will get you speaking confidently in your new language. Choose from Spanish, French, and more. You'll learn through real-life dialogues, speech recognition, and interactive trainers. And Babbel's spaced repetition method actually makes you remember what you've learned. Download the app or go to Babbel, BABBEL.com, to try Babbel for free.
Our rent price is leveling off. What's the best job after college? And is our labor market actually healthy? Listen to Planet Money's daily podcast, The Indicator, to find out.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're speaking with Anthony Abraham Jack about his new book, The Privileged Poor. One listener who chose to remain anonymous, which is just fine, emailed, "I was born and raised in Southern California to a poor Mexican immigrant working class family of seven. We often went to sleep hungry, and my parents never really pushed college. I was accepted to a predominantly white private liberal arts college in the East Coast, and the first few years were tough. But my senior year, I fell into a deep depression and with no health insurance and no real safety net. I never finished my degree. I was three courses short. That was 23 years ago, and it haunts me today." Rebecca tweeted, "I was the first person in my family to go to college. College and work were a culture shock. I had to learn how to talk, dress, and act. A year out of school, a coworker told me I'd need to fix my teeth to advance my career. It never occurred to me that was important." Anthony, can you resonate with any of these things, little things that you learned along the way that you kind of discovered like, oh, that's a thing when you're playing in this kind of universe?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of hidden rules and all these kind of ways that we are evaluated in these individual, like small micro moments that are, quite frankly, as consequential as the big moments. I'm saddened to hear about the mental health and the depression, because that's something that we actually need to tackle head on college campuses today. I wish and I hope that more and more universities are not only providing mental health services as part of the university health plan, but also increasing the number of appointments that you can have before students have to start paying. But if we are going to tackle mental health on a college campus, we have to understand the diversity of students' help-seeking strategies. There are some students who feel perfectly comfortable going and knocking on professor's door. Others are not. If a student is not comfortable asking for an extension on an assignment, how then are they going to feel comfortable asking for a diagnosis? We have to pay attention to the diverse strategies that we have on our college campus and how social class shapes that. Because if not, we will always have students who are in need of help, who are the least likely to get it.
And depending on your cultural background, we know that there are certain cultural backgrounds that have very strong views against seeking mental health treatment. We heard from a number of first-generation students who told us they struggled to prepare for college partly because their parents had no idea how to engage them in that. Here is one such message that landed in our inbox.
Hi, my name's Noelle. I'm from Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Neither of my parents or grandparents went to college, and I have three brothers. We all experienced graduating from high school and then kind of not knowing what to do next. We would go to community college for a bit, take different classes, work full-time sometimes, and eventually work our way towards, really getting into school. I think our parents just didn't know what was expected of a high school student as far as applying to colleges, visiting colleges, doing interviews, et cetera. And now I am 27 years old. I have two children, and I am a junior at a small art school.
Noelle, thanks for sharing your story with us. Best of luck to you, not only with the little ones, but also with your education. Professor Jack, what would you say to Noelle?
First of all, thank you for sharing that story. And it brings up something that I saw a lot in the research, the difference between support and specifics. A lot of lower income students and first generation college students, their families were able to give support. We want you to do this kind of aspiration, like support and aspirational dreams. Like, you want to go to college, we want to support you in that. But the specifics of how to support their kids was lost. Because not only did they not have access to the information that they needed, but they didn't experience it themselves. And so sometimes parents' advice goes against what then would be the best advice they would get in school.
Give me an example.
So I had a student who told me that her father, and this goes back to the help-seeking piece, her father said, "You don't want to make it by kissing butt. You want to make it by your hard work, because you'll feel more," he used the words, "more proud of that, of accomplishing something based upon your work as compared to networking." And she tried to do that. She used her father's yardstick as a measurement tool to say, what should she do? And that actually helped. That helped her get overlooked in college, because she never spoke up. Her teachers didn't know her names. When it was time to ask for Les' recommendation, not only did she not feel comfortable, she didn't have anyone to go to. And so she felt lost towards the end of her junior year. And it wasn't until that senior year that she forced herself and got some support. But using that was a using her family as a yardstick.
As we continue our conversation with Anthony Abraham Jack, let's add another voice into the discussion about one way that one university is trying to help fill that gap. Also here with us in studio is Melissa Foy, who also goes by Missy. She's the executive director of the Georgetown Scholars Program at Georgetown University here in Washington. Melissa, welcome to the program.
It's a huge honor to be here.
Tell us about the Georgetown Scholars Program. What does it do?
So started in 2005, our mission is to assist and walk with students to and through college. And we do that in four key ways. We build a community among students on campus of first-gen and low-income students. We provide mentorship via alumni mentors and upper-class peer mentors. We provide financial assistance, so beyond their traditional financial aid package, which allegedly meets full financial need of students. We provide money for counseling, medical co-pays, winter coats, additional flights home for emergencies or to offset homesickness. And then the fourth piece is advocacy, you know, working ourselves out of a job on our own campus to hopefully make the entire university as inclusive as possible.
Can you paint me a picture, Missy, of the students that you tend to deal with, the kinds of backgrounds they come from, whether they tend to come from one or two different racial or cultural backgrounds? What's the profile like?
So we work with 650 undergraduate students, and literally from every background you could possibly imagine. We do have a handful of international students. Undocumented students are also make up a portion of our community. Interestingly enough, about 90% of our students come from public schools. They're not necessarily the most under-resourced public schools. They may have been in a community where they had access to a better public school, but so in terms of the privileged poor, only about 10% of students in our program would fall into probably that particular category.
Melissa, you recently launched a one-credit course at Georgetown called Mastering the Hidden Curriculum. What's the hidden curriculum at Georgetown?
I think you have to pick up Dr. Jack's book to find to find that out.
Well, without spoiling too much of this of the secret, what? Give me an example of what's in this hidden curriculum.
Well, actually, Dr. Jack does have an incredible story about office hours and how a student perceives that.
Would you share that story?
Sure. Part of the hidden curriculum, like I said, is the unset expectations. We, as faculty members, and I've traveled the country asking the same question. We always say when our office hours are. We never say what office hours are. We never take the time, that next step, to actually explain something that, because we have been used to teaching students who either come from a family or have the educational pedigree that have prepared them to know that office hours are not only a specific time in which faculty are dedicated to meeting with students, but it's that moment where connections are made, where faculty get to know students' interests, their drives, beyond what is said in the class. That is the road to letters of recommendation, emotional support, extensions, support when you may have done something wrong, but someone is going to be be your advocate, so you don't get into as much trouble. That is one moment of the hidden curriculum that we just need to actually unpack. We need to question what we take for granted that we know that we think our students either know or have access to.
Now, see, it's interesting you mentioned that because I used to teach journalism at UC Berkeley. I taught in fall 15 and fall 16 graduate students, and they almost never came to office hours. They were super driven, and I am painfully proud of the students that I taught. And so for me, I kind of wonder, like, well, gee, dang, they just don't need me here. Your experience sounds like the exact opposite, where students wouldn't show up not because they knew what they were doing, but because they didn't know that they didn't know what they were doing. They didn't know what they didn't know.
A dean at Dean College in Massachusetts emailed me, and she was like, Tony, what can we do to help our students? And I shared with her, define office hours. And she said, you know what? That's a very interesting suggestion, because I actually sat down in my class and asked my students why they never came to see me. And she said, well, the students told her, well, you said that your office hours are from 2 to 4. We thought that was your time to do your work. Something was lost in translation. and yet we didn't pick up on that moment.
I want to talk more about how we improve that interface between students, staff, faculty, administration when we continue with Harvard Assistant Professor Anthony Abraham Jack and Melissa Foy, Executive Director of Georgetown's Georgetown Scholars Program. We'll get to more of your questions and thoughts as well. Stay close.
This message comes from NPR sponsor ADT. America's trusted home security company can help protect you against break-ins, fires, and carbon monoxide. 24/7 emergency response when you need it most. More at ADT.com.
In the Trump era, the news moves faster than ever, and the NPR Politics podcast is there to keep you informed. Every time there's a major political story, we get our best correspondents together to sort through the noise. The NPR Politics Podcast, what you need to know right after it happens.
Back now to our conversation with Anthony Abraham Jack and Melissa Foy. The office hour story struck a nerve with Michael, who wrote on our Facebook page, instead of office hours, why not call them open hours or available hours to help students understand what is when faculty and professors are available for them. Melissa, what about that? What about teaching teachers and administrators how to be culturally sensitive to these differences? I'm sure that the Georgetown community is lovely, but educators have a lot to worry about. And I'm guessing that some would bristle a little bit at being told, what do you mean I don't know how to deal with my students? I love my students. I don't need you to tell me how to deal with my students. My students love me and I love them back. How do you build that bridge?
It is a delicate thing. And there are hierarchies at universities. And as a staff member, I'm aware that in the food chain, a faculty member probably is, you know, might assume, what is this staff member trying to tell me? So we've gotten at it in another way, which I think is actually really creative and a testament to the faculty members who really do get it and are very excited about it. We have a first generation faculty and staff initiative at Georgetown of a couple hundred faculty and staff who identify as first generation college graduates or allies. And they have t-shirts that they might wear on the first day of class. They have pennants that they put in their offices. And they talk about it. They also mentor undergraduate students. So that has been a way of sort of changing the culture on our campus, is just by having embedded ambassadors in multiple spaces.
Professor Jack, Georgetown is a Jesuit university. Jesuit institutions have a very strong ethical focus on social justice. And so I can see how something like this fits neatly into the ethos of a school like Georgetown. Are there certain kinds of colleges and universities where this kind of conversation you find doesn't fit or is especially difficult? Are there certain kinds of schools that tend to be either more resistant to it or where there are just more problems to work through?
So when it comes to any one particular institution, no, because there's research that shows that the miscommunication and the missed moments between faculty and students happens at community college, state colleges, liberal arts college. It doesn't matter. There isn't necessarily like one particular vibe or one kind of community that makes the reception any better. I do, and here's where also like diversity of the faculty and staff plays a role, but that was beyond the scope of the research, because we also know that women scholars of color, let alone women who are scholars of color, pay that tax of being disproportionately the person that students, especially lower income students, other students who are women, go to. They write more or less recommendation. I know Roberto Gonzalez has started tweeting, was my colleague at Harvard, tweeting how many letters of recommendation he writes in a semester, and seeing the difference between how some of our colleagues who are male and or white, their numbers look very different. So there is a tax that faculty members have. So it's also very interesting who is doing the emotional labor of this work and who's disproportionately not targeted in a negative way, but targeted as a person who is more receptive to actually giving the help, also plays a role in this.
These issues with the privileged poor or the doubly disadvantaged, do you find that they are equally pernicious at historically black colleges and universities? or are HBCUs doing it differently from kind of from the get-go?
I have not studied HBCUs in the same way as I have small liberal arts colleges and kind of like the Ivies. Though in conversations and also conversation with past presidents, class still is an issue. And class as in both economic capital, like how much money you have, but also this kind of these social codes play a role in how students navigate all institutions. But I myself have not studied HBCUs in the same way.
Let's talk about spring break for a minute, because that can also create some challenges. A lot of colleges don't accommodate students for whom spring break becomes an economic challenge. Professor Jack, you spoke to, you wrote rather, about one student who used Tinder to kind of survive spring break, the social networking dating app. How did that go?
When we think about spring break, we think about everybody going to fun, the sun, going to the beach, going out to party. But the reality is, on a lot of our campuses across the country, spring break equals closures of cafeterias. And that means that schools, by their own policies, induce food insecurity. Students don't know where their next meal is coming from. Students go hungry for days on end or live off food that they either steal from their own cafeterias and live off increasingly stale, or they use or they get creative in finding meals. And as one young white woman spoke to me at a conference, and she said that in the week leading up to spring break, she increased her online dating activity to secure dates for the next week. Banking on older men paying for the first meal, she lined up first dates, that week to make sure that she had meals, because she couldn't afford to pay for meals and she didn't have access to a fridge and all that kind of other stuff that we take for granted that students have access to, because either they leave or they want to stay or they can stay and they can afford to. And that's actually not the case.
So she was basically dating as a means of eating.
Yes.
Melissa, how does Georgetown deal with this when it occurs? Maybe not something quite that extreme, but this kind of food insecurity.
We do have inexpensive or free alternative break programming available to Georgetown students, but we in particular give students grocery grants. We also have a food pantry on our campus, and that's something that you're seeing more schools do. And on the one hand, it's not an attractive look, right? Why does a school like Georgetown have a food pantry? On the other hand, like, it's meeting a necessary need.
We heard from a number of first-generation college students who struggled with being able to buy food, including this one, who left a note in our inbox.
Hi, my name is Q Vonda, and I'm from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I wanted to comment on being a college student who had to worry about paying bills at home and trying to struggle with the concept of going to school and trying to better my life and get out of poverty, which I grew up in, and also trying to work and pay my bills at home and keep afloat. It was a lot of days that I went to school hungry, and I was hungry all day. And it was very demoralizing sometimes to just eat off of my classmates' plates sometimes or just not say anything. It was just very hard to concentrate and be a nursing student and having to be on my own and work at the same time.
Yeah, I imagine so. Q Vonda, thanks very much for sharing your story with us. Professor Jack, there are some schools that, as we've said, have developed food pantries for students. There was a study that came out last month from the Government Accountability Office that found that nearly 2 million students from low-income backgrounds who were eligible for food assistance didn't get the benefits. Nearly 2 million.
Yes.
What is going on here?
Well, one, the lack of information, because I would bet that a number of those students didn't know that they were eligible. Second, I think also we go back to who knows how and who feels comfortable asking for help and who knows how to get it. That report is a very important examination of the real college experience on for today's students, because food insecurity undercuts academic performance. It undercuts retention efforts, sense of belonging, let alone the physical effects. One thing I would add to the report, and while we're talking about spring break, is we need information on both not just the number, but also the nature. For college students, there are some students who experience it episodically, like those who happen during spring break, Thanksgiving break, winter break. Mm-hmm. And that's when food pantries and other on-campus initiatives can be very helpful. But these students, those 2 million, that's who face it chronically. those who face it day in and day out three or more times a week. And I'm indebted to the work of Sarah Gowick, Rob, and others who are bringing attention to this issue. But I would push people to think that we need to also pay attention to the nature of it. Where is it episodic? Because that leads to different initiatives to tackle it. And where is it chronic? Because that's when we need government aid.
I want to talk solutions in the last few minutes we have left, but let me read two more comments, including one from an HBCU student. One member of the 1A Text Club writes, "My sister was the first to go to college and I was the second. I'm a black woman that went to a predominantly white, all-girls Catholic high school in California. Some of the overt and covert racist experiences there made me ultimately choose to go to an HBCU, and it's one of the best decisions I've ever made." Isaac in St. Louis writes, "This is a painful subject for me, but I'm very happy that it's a subject you're addressing. I attended Washington University, having grown up in a single-parent home in a working-class black neighborhood and having attended overwhelmingly black schools prior to college. Having graduated from an elite university has been more of a curse than a blessing. I've been discriminated against by both whites and blacks because I was assumed to be either an undeserving token or because of people who thought that I felt that I was better because I graduated from an elite university. I left with few contacts to assist in my career, and the university offered no assistance in networking. I knew nothing about the importance that cultivating such contacts amongst alumni would be." In our last few minutes, I wonder how we begin to move this forward and whose responsibility it is. It occurs to me, Melissa, and I'm not asking you to tell tales out of school, but if Georgetown's wealthiest white alumni said, "This is a problem and we want it fixed before the sun sets on the 2019 academic year," this would change. Who has the most power to change this?
To change the experience of low-income students?
And make sure that the privileged poor and the doubly disadvantaged don't have to scrap their way through college.
I mean, we have to solve poverty in our country, I think. That's where it has to begin, because it's everywhere. There are federal limitations on what an institution like Georgetown can do. I can see a student in front of me who's sending money home to pay the electric bill or the water bill so their water isn't cut off at home for their siblings. Technically, I'm not allowed to give that student money to do that. So I don't know. I mean, I think it really involves solving for poverty in our country to begin with. I do think that schools certainly can do more, obviously, or I wouldn't be doing this work.
Right.
I think in developing programs, advocacy work for students across campus, I think even introducing students to one another, we're seeing this grassroots movement among students in Align and IVG. You know, students are taking it upon themselves to build community so that they can know each other and walk with each other through this. So I think that's one thing, but I really would like the onus to be on the university's shoulders, and I think more schools can follow in our footsteps.
Professor Jack, for students, alumni, faculty, administrators who are motivated to move on this, whether they are wealthy alumni or not, give me one example of something that you wish all universities would do more of, just about all universities, to make headway in this situation. What's at the top of your list of things to do?
Right now, I think universities need to open themselves up more to either internal research or research from the outside to actually understand what are the obstacles that students face. I think universities must get a sense of just how food insecure their students are, and also housing insecure their students are, because Aesop taught us a long time ago in his fables, if you cannot eat, you cannot learn. If you are worried about where you are going to rest your head, you are not focusing as much on the, you know, Marx's theory of history or Carbonyl chemistry. You are worried about making it. And we need to address those fundamental problems, and we need information on that. It's not a shame. Colleges shouldn't feel ashamed or feel they have to sweep it under the carpet. We need to actually know what problems our students face if we are going to help them through it.
Anthony Abraham Jack, an assistant professor of education and a junior fellow at Harvard. His new book is called The Privileged Poor: How Elite Colleges Are Failing Disadvantaged Students. Professor Jack, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
And Melissa Foy, the executive director of the Georgetown Scholars Program at Georgetown University. Melissa, thank you.
Thank you.
This conversation was produced by Danielle Knight and Lindsay Foster Thomas and edited by Miranda Fulmore. You can learn more about them and the rest of our team online at the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.